Well, nice to see everybody. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Gregory Shushan, who's the Perrott Warwick researcher at the Ian Ramsey Centre for the Study of Science and Religion in the Theology Faculty. Gregory has written a book on, I can never remember the title, Conceptions of the Afterlife in Early Civilizations, Universalism, Constructivism and the Near-Death Experience. Mm. And he's interested in the possibilities of comparativism and the idea of universal religious experience. And I imagine he's going to speak to us about that today in his talk, The Relationship Between Religious Experience and Religious Belief, Essentialism, Scholarly Naivety, or Logical Positivism. Mm. So, Gregory, over to you.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to stick to the script to kind of make sure I'm precise in what I'm saying, so I hope it's not too tedious. Criticisms in the study of religious experience over the past 30 years or so intersect with debates surrounding the cross-cultural comparison of religions in general. Because they regard religions as purely cultural constructs, as opposed to being rooted in some kind of universal divine reality, critics see both comparison and religious experience as crypto-theological subjects, if not overtly theological subjects, particularly when claims of a common core or universality are made. Religious experience has been singled out by certain postmodern scholars as being especially non-comparable. They argue that there can be no such thing as unmediated religious experience, because experience cannot be independent of language and culture. Thus, the argument goes, there's no sensible way we can talk about some unique event called religious experience, or that's identifiable as religious experience at all. All of this means that it is supposedly unintelligible to look to religious experience for the origins of religious beliefs, the experiential source hypothesis, as opposed to the cultural source hypothesis, to use the terms of the folklorist David Hufford. For postmodernists, though, it's not so much a chicken or egg question, which comes first, religious belief or religious experience. It's more of a claim that there was never any egg to begin with. The rhetoric of these kinds of experiences, of these kinds of arguments, has grown increasingly extremist and dogmatic, really, over time, starting with works like Stephen Katz in the 1970s, to Wayne Proudfoot in the 80s, and Robert Scharf in the 90s. And most recently, in the recent issue of the journal Religion, Matthew Day writes, "The very idea of religious experience now looks like a curio from the past rather than something to be taken seriously." And he actually expresses hope that the subject will not be rehabilitated on any sort of academic level. Well, I don't always disagree with postmodern critiques of particular studies. I do object to the way that these critiques are applied to the study of religious experience per se, as if the topic itself is at fault. So this paper will attempt to demonstrate the weaknesses in arguments against the study of religious experience by showing that they're based on a number of mutually reliant axioms which are far from being universally accepted. But first, one critique with which I fully agree is the need for clarity of meaning when it comes to terminology. Religious experience is often used synonymously with terms like ecstatic or mystical or peak or exceptional human experience. And these are used to categorize diverse kinds of non-quotidian experience, like healings or visions, feelings of unity, out-of-body experiences, and so on. Sociologist James McLennan uses wondrous events as his term. Ann Taves uses special to describe the types of experiences people deem religious, which is good because it emphasizes that the classification is cultural, whatever they actually are, beyond culture, if there is such a thing as that, which we'll get into. But I agree with Ann Taves when she argues, rather than abandon the study of experience, we should disaggregate the concept of religious experience and study the wide range of experiences to which religious significance has been attributed. So, so much for my agreement with the postmodern stance. Now, as one of Robert Scharf's key claims is that we cannot separate a narrative of an experience from the experience itself. And this is one of the kind of key sticking points of the postmodern argument. Scharf does attempt to clarify that he's not denying subjective experience, although he does state, "It is a mistake to approach literary, artistic, or ritual representations as if they referred back to something other than themselves, to some numinous inner realm." Scharf then acknowledges that his readers must be thinking that surely The vigorous and often exuberant language used by mystics the world over to describe their visions, trances, and states of cosmic union must refer to something. And indeed we are. Just what do these tens, if not hundreds of thousands of reports by individuals in so many places and times around the world refer to, if not to the experiences they're actually purporting to refer to? So at the most basic level, this begs the question, what gives rise to the representation, if not experience? Particularly when the representations can have cross-culturally consistent phenomenologies, as well as cross-culturally consistent locally ascribed meanings. This is the case with near-death experiences, NDEs, and out-of-body experiences, OBEs, which I'll be referring to mostly today as examples, as particular types of religious experience. Furthermore, how is it that similar types of narratives can be categorized in consistent ways by so many different researchers, literally enabling the study of shamanic experiences, for example? In other words, if they have no actual experiential referent, how is it that reports of ostensible experiences can be similar enough to be classified into types? Categories are arrived at through phenomenological observation and comparison. To illustrate his point that narratives of religious experience do not refer to actual experience, Scharf draws a comparison with alien abduction. He argues that because the scholarly consensus is that alien abductions do not actually take place, there can be no originating experience behind alleged memories of alien abductions. Leaving aside the fact that there is no such scholarly consensus regarding religious experience, there are other conceptual problems with this example. Scharf states that while alien abduction is not fully understood, its roots will be found to lie in complex historical, sociological, and psychological processes. While I don't dispute that, I do wonder, are these processes not types of experience? And given the overall similarity of the accounts of alien abductions, it seems that these processes would be comparable between the alleged abductees, as actually appears to be the case, which I'll get back to. Scharf draws comparisons between alien abduction and reports of tales of shamanic trance journeys, and note, by the way, his use of tales rather than, say, something like narratives. He asks, is there any reason to assume that reports of mystics, reports of experiences by mystics, shamans, or meditation masters are any more credible as phenomenological descriptions than those of abductees? I would ask in response here, if they are not credible as phenomenological descriptions of some kind of experience, again, how is it that they can be identified and generally categorized in the first place? And these are identifications and categorizations which Scharf himself cannot avoid using. So it's difficult to see what kind of proof there could ever be that the masses of descriptions of shamanic journeys, for example, cross-culturally, do not refer to some kind of comparable experience. I also have to confess that I don't quite follow Scharf's reasoning when he states that he doesn't deny subjective experience, but that a description of it cannot actually refer to it. There's a similar issue with Proudfoot, as G. William Bernard has pointed out. On the one hand, he states that the interpretations are themselves constitutive of the experiences, but on the other, he states religious experiences are often private, personal, interior, and direct. And Brian Bocking, who rightly reminds us that narratives about experiences are narratives, not the original experience. Though at the same time, he seems to support Scharf's central argument that narratives of religious experience do not actually refer to any experience. So how can there be a narrative about an experience that is not actually about an experience? I'm confused about this. These seem to be internally contradictory views to me, which make me wonder that even if the proponents haven't quite worked them out entirely, either that or the finer points have not been articulated in a way that I at least find entirely consistent or even fully coherent, given the apparent contradictions. As Brian Rennie writes, observation assures us that there's a distinction between claim and experience. To anyone who has any kind of experience, having it and relating it are not the same thing. Of course, none of this is to deny that religious experience is culturally mediated, filtered, interpreted, and expressed in cultural terms, resulting in a narrative that is largely a cultural artifact. Neither the experience nor its interpretation can be divorced from culture. So I agree with Scharf that mystical experience is wholly shaped by a mystic's cultural environment, personal history, doctrinal commitments, religious training, expectations, aspirations, and so on. But shaped by is not the same thing as created by. Accepting that all experience is culturally mediated is not the same as accepting that it's culturally fabricated. So I disagree with Carol Zaleski, for example, when she argues that because experience cannot be divorced from culture, the notion that some original and essential religious experience can be discriminated from subsequent layers of cultural shaping is erroneous and must be renounced. I would argue that we can acknowledge the cultural component without denying that experience can have pre-cultural origins. Whether those are neurophysiological or psychological or supernatural is irrelevant here. As Sally King argues, religious experience can precede culture, but this does not preclude cultural influence on the processing and interpretation of the experience. So we need not conceive of religious experience as being any less mediated than any other kind of experience, or any more mediated. Any experience by nature includes individual, cultural, and universal human elements. Indeed, the existence of cross-cultural similarities between certain types of experience shows that they must originate in phenomena which are independent of culture. For example, attempts to explain near-death experiences in reductionist terms involve physical and therefore universal events and processes. Things like REM intrusion and anoxia and hypercarbia and epiphenomena of the biologically universal brain, which is going through these kind of events and processes which are supposed to cause NDEs. These effects caused by these kinds of events have identifiable phenomenologies. Otherwise, medical practitioners would not be able to predict their impact on patients. And critics of the veridicality of NDEs would not be able to formulate theories based on their occurrence, reducing them to processes of the brain. And furthermore, the drug ketamine is known to mimic the effects of NDEs, as reported by individuals who have had both types of experience, and this demonstrates an objective phenomenology of two experience types. This brings us back to the idea that narratives can refer to an actual experience. To accept a consistent phenomenology for one type of experience simply because it has medically identifiable origins, in the case of taking a drug like ketamine, but not for another on the grounds that some claim that it doesn't, in the case of near-death experience, would be an example either of cognitive dissonance or an anti-scientific double standard which places theoretical allegiances before actual evidence. So to summarize, the fact that one's culture influences one's experiences does nothing to prove that objective experience does not occur. The experience can be caused by the same mechanism or agency and therefore characterized by similar structural features, though the way it's experienced and interpreted and understood is culturally and individually situated. So we may remain enculturated beings even as we are experiencing. So I think the whole issue of whether or not there can be mediated or unmediated experience has really been overstated. But nevertheless, let's look a bit closer at the axiom that experience cannot be pre-cultural. Is there actually any convincing empirical evidence to support this claim? Actually, it appears that there isn't. Seeing emotions as analogous to religious experience, Wayne Proudfoot claimed that emotions are not inner states or events, nor are they somatic sensations or even experiences of any kind. His position was usefully summarized by Bernard that emotions are simply cognitions superimposed upon a physiological substratum according to the logic of the social context. In other words, there is no physiological difference between emotional states, and it's therefore interpretation which makes us have diverse emotions at all. And from this, Proudfoot extrapolated that the same must apply to religious experience. However, as both Bernard and McLennan have shown, the key study used by Proudfoot to support his contentions, a psychological study by Stanley Schachter and Jerome Singer, was highly criticized at the time of publication, which was 1962, and has since been effectively refuted by nearly 50 years of further research. As Bernard summarized, the more general consensus is that there are different physiological sensations associated with different emotions, and that cognition and emotion are now seen as different classes of phenomena. Most importantly here, it is also now generally accepted that emotions can actually affect cognition as well as vice versa. So if emotional experience can precede cognition, we may extrapolate, as Proudfoot did in reverse, that religious experience can also precede cognition. Without the evidence that Proudfoot relied upon, all that's left of his claim is philosophical speculation, which he himself acknowledges. His conclusions, and by extension, that of his followers, are therefore unwarranted and misleading, as Bernard states. According to McLennan, recent research into the relationship between perception, emotion, and cognition suggests that explanations of religious experiences are influenced by environmental and cultural factors, but not fully produced by them. So in short, the assumption that there is no such thing as pre-cultural experience is just that, an assumption. So why should we give primacy to culture over experience anyway? Where does culture come from? While we certainly could not argue that culture is sui generis, it's possible at least to argue that experience is. Another indication that religious experience can be pre-cultural is that they can actually conflict with the cultural expectations of the individual, as Sally King has pointed out. Atheists, for example, have NDEs, which are consistent with those of religious people. There's an interesting early 20th century Zuni Native American near-death experience narrative, which includes encounters with deceased relatives and bright lights, which are motifs inconsistent with Zuni afterlife conceptions. And similarly, medieval Chinese, Japanese, and European return-from-death narratives often don't conform to the theological conventions of their time and place. If they're strictly cultural products, why should they differ from the dominant beliefs of the culture from which they emerge? And conversely, certain expected religion-specific elements are not reported in near-death experiences. For example, Hindus and Western Christians don't have experiences of salvation or reincarnation when they describe their near-death experiences. There is a degree of variability between NDEs, and that seems to be due to the duration of the experience, the depth of it. People don't all generally experience all of the typical structural elements. So even those familiar with the phenomenon may wonder why they didn't go through a tunnel or have a life review, for example. The experience is thus, in part, independent of its cultural context. The point has been made by the philosopher John Searle that culture biases our perceptions, it does not generate them. And perception, of course, is a type of experience. We then have the ability to analyze those perceptions in a variety of ways, including trying to sift out what is actual from our own cultural overlays. In addition to being enculturated beings, we're also reflective, analytical individuals. Critics also raise the issue of cross-linguistic analogies, that it's problematic to believe that certain concepts or terms will have counterparts in other languages, and this is even more problematic when we're dealing with experiences that are so often characterized as ineffable. But while there may not be a truly analogous term for mystical, for example, in all languages and all modes of thought, this does not indicate that something like what we would term mystical is not actually experienced by individuals in other cultures. In a recent survey of religious experience in China, individuals reported just such experiences, and they actually associated them with religious or supernatural ideas or beliefs, whatever they called them. This is despite the fact that there's no regular term in no regular Chinese term for religious experience. The fact that people negotiate experiences on their own cultural linguistic terms has no bearing on the question of whether or not people actually have phenomenologically analogous experiences cross-culturally. Indeed, I think dwelling on this concept, on this issue, sidesteps the fact that experiences sometimes are described and interpreted in similar ways cross-culturally. Furthermore, if experience is cross-linguistically inexpressible, how is it that ideas of any kind can be made intelligible from one language, one cultural linguistic context into another? Humans do have the ability to be genuinely bilingual as well as bicultural. Or do critics mean that only religious experience is cross-linguistically inexpressible? And this raises the issue of the negative exceptionalization of religious experience. Despite the claim that theological and crypto-theological scholars elevate religious experience, critics such as Scharf and Proudfoot are in fact perpetuating their exceptionalization. Singling them out as a type of experience that cannot exist cross-culturally categorizes them as somehow apart from other types of human experience. This serves to implicitly justify Scharf's claim that religious experience is inaccessible to strictly objective modes of inquiry. leaving aside, again, that much of Scharf's argument seems to be predicated on the non-existence of strict objectivity in the first place, there are, in fact, objective ways of studying religious experience. And Taves points out that we can obtain real-time neurological data from experiences in progress and observe the actions and reactions of people having religious experiences. We can examine how the subject relates the experience or conduct comparative analyses of the content of narratives in cross-cultural contexts or between individuals and sample groups. And I would argue that cross-cultural comparison can be as objective as any other kind of research. This has been done in laboratory-based studies on shamanic states. Various near-death experience researchers have designed experiments to test empirically whether out-of-body experiences actually occur or not. There are, in fact, as many approaches to the objective study of religious experience as there are to any kind of experience. From a theoretical and methodological perspective, to recognize the cross-cultural occurrence of these experiences and to intellectually engage with them as human experiences is little different from doing so with any type of human experience. Mourning, the loss of a loved one, for example, is universal, but is culturally expressed. So if the concept of religious experience is untenable, then why isn't the concept of loss experience or fear experience or any other kind of experience? So it seems to me that in order to accept that religious experience is non-referential and meaningless as a cross-cultural category, one must also accept that this applies to all experience per se. And if that is, in fact, what the postmodernist critics are saying, I think the onus is on them to actually demonstrate these claims in the face of all evidence and common sense observation to the contrary, as opposed to merely constructing abstract philosophical arguments. Notwithstanding all that, I do think that religious experiences are actually exceptional, and it is important to acknowledge that special elevated status is given to certain kinds of experiences cross-culturally. It's clear that while there may be exceptions, people generally do perceive a difference between sensations of one's awareness being inside the body or out of it, for example, between encountering a living person or a ghost, between being dead and coming back to life, staying dead and coming back to life. So regardless of whether these things actually occur, people around the world have been reporting them throughout recorded history and generally conceiving of them as being in a separate category to everyday quotidian occurrences. And I think that very pattern of cultural ascription is an important indicator of their cross-cultural comparability. Let's turn now to the problem of our own cultural situatedness as Western academics, which is another issue that's often brought up in comparison, as well as about religious experience and various other things. It's fashionable in postmodern circles to trace the lineage of an academic category from the present backwards, with the intention of demonstrating how it ultimately lies in some Western colonialist construct. Basic signifiers like Hinduism, myth, and religion. Proudfoot adopts this approach to argue that the very concept of religious experience, and particularly of seeing religion in terms of such experience, can be traced only as far back as Schleiermacher, so late 18th, early 19th centuries. Therefore, because this category is comparatively recent and Western, it should not be applied to anything before Schleiermacher, and it should not be applied cross-culturally. This is because, as Scharf summarizes, it anachronistically imposes the recent and ideologically laden notion of religious experience on our interpretations of pre-modern phenomena. But is this really a valid reason? Most contemporary models of religious phenomena, anthropological, sociological, psychological, for example, did not exist in the pre-modern world, though we nevertheless routinely impose them upon pre-modern and non-Western religions. Because ancient Greeks did not have cognitive science, should we not try to understand ancient Greek religion in cognitive scientific terms? I'm not saying we should, but I'm not saying that it's an invalid pursuit. And for that matter, what about imposing ideologically laden postmodern notions onto pre-modern religions? Is there any model of religion we can acceptably impose upon the past or on the other without that kind of criticism? So I think the argument is clearly another example of the negative exceptionalization of religious experience. Scharf also argues that there is simply no evidence of an indigenous Indian counterpart to the rhetoric of experience prior to the colonial period. While this may very well be correct, He goes a step further and follows Proudfoot, claiming that religious experience, and apparently meaning religious experience itself, is a relatively late and distinctly Western invention. Anomalous experiences are clearly described in ancient Indian, other Asian, and pre-Schleiermacher Western religious texts, confirming that they are neither late nor Western nor an invention. While the religious context of the narratives demonstrates that anomalous experiences are frequently cross-culturally interpreted in religious terms. Return from death, out of body, and unitive experiences are described in the Vedas, the Brahmanas, the Upanishads. The Atharva Veda contains shamanic-type practical texts for bringing the soul back from the underworld and returning it to the body. There's an abundance of narratives from China in texts such as the Chu Si and Zhuangzi, forgive my pronunciation, which are overtly rooted in shamanism and contain descriptions of traveling out of the body to other realms. If you're interested, you'll find numerous examples with specific references in my book on the reading list, and I'm sure a lot of you will have examples of your own that you can think of. I have no doubt that Scharf is correct about the particular ancient Buddhist texts that he gives as examples, but to use them as evidence to support generalizations about Asian and pre-modern religions and about religious experience per se is, I think, a serious methodological error. Scharf presents his arguments about flawed academic notions of religious experience in Buddhism as an axiomatic characterization of the study of religious experience as a whole. This is where phenomenology and cross-cultural comparison is useful, because they can test these kinds of overgeneralizing claims. So my point being here, even if the concept of experience as a category or a rhetorical tool is a recent Western invention, this has no bearing whatsoever on whether or not claims of experiences cross-culturally actually refer to experiences, or how interpretations of those experiences might relate to religious beliefs. Yet another example of the negative exceptionalization of religious experience is Brian Bocking's view that, in light of Scharf's argument, it is naive to think that religious beliefs are grounded in religious experiences, so we should not look to religious experience for the origins of religious belief. Like any sort of human experience, any sort of knowledge or belief, religious beliefs must be rooted in some kind of human experience, the only kind of experience that we actually have. So what types of human experiences are valid as possible explanations for the origins of religious beliefs, and on what grounds? Among the repertoire of experiences humans have are ones which, within their cultural context, are considered to be anomalous, as well as being inexplicable without reference to the supernatural or metaphysical. As a type of human experience obviously relevant to religious beliefs, it would seem to be a logical candidate to help us explain the origins of such beliefs, meaning anomalous experiences would. The only grounds for discounting the possibility is the dubious axiom that narratives about religious experience are non-referential. Otherwise, the notion is no more controversial or substantively different even than attempts to explain religions in terms of how we experience or negotiate our societies or our environments, or, again, explaining mourning in terms of loss. McLennan cites studies of people who have had experiences of apparitions, hauntings, poltergeists, seances, etc., which demonstrate that the experience led to beliefs in the supernatural, not vice versa. He writes, contrary to the desires of skeptics, folklore stories do induce belief. People have experiences, they tell others, and folk traditions result. And what is belief within a folk tradition but a kind of religion? Taves argues along similar lines that ascriptions of specialness to certain types of experiences are the building blocks of religion. Alien abduction, again, offers a useful analogy here. A psychologist, Susan Clancy, has theorized that the phenomenon of alien abduction is due to a cross-culturally recognized psychological state called sleep paralysis. This involves being in a sort of half-awake, half-dreaming state, and is characterized by a sense of immobilization and someone holding you down by your chest, and also by a sense in the room of a malevolent presence. While people who have these experiences describe them in broadly similar ways, culture-specific meanings are ascribed to them and to the alleged agency involved, This results in beliefs in an old hag in North America and particular types of ghosts and demons in Fiji, Turkey, Nigeria, and various other places where this phenomenon has been recorded, and quite possibly in alien abduction beliefs as well. So in other words, some kind of experience, whatever sleep paralysis actually lies in, the psychological process is leading to some kind of belief. While Anne Taves thinks that it's premature to extend this kind of theory to religious beliefs, she also refers to sleep paralysis as a quintessential example of experiences that seem sui generis. But is it premature? I think we would be hard-pressed to find many religions without some kind of experiential event understood to be miraculous or supernatural as a key element expressed in its foundational texts and continuously accepted by its adherents. And these are often associated with particular individuals who are elevated for having them. Prophecies, healings, transubstantiations, encounters and communications with gods, spirits, demons, unusual births, and so on. And while I don't claim that the pursuit of religious experience is necessarily an integral part of religious teachings, agreeing with both Scharf and Bocking, afterlife-related experiences in general, such as journeys to other realms, enlightenment, and resurrection, are often presented as models to be followed by the individual at death. There are numerous examples of modern religions which trace their origins directly to anomalous experiences reported by their founders. From Baha'u'llah's vision, which led to him starting the Baha'i faith, to Cao Dai, formed in Vietnam in the 1920s, directly after divine communications during seances. Even alien abduction has led to the founding of at least one new religious movement, Raelism, in France, and telepathic communications with aliens, allegedly, has been responsible for the founding of other religions, including the Aetherius Society here in the UK, and the Universe People in the Czech Republic. So I hope it's obvious that my argument is not that all religions in their entirety are always rooted in the same essential experience. Acknowledging that beliefs in a supernatural origin of certain experience types are a factor in the formation of religious ideas does not entail seeing diverse traditions or experiences as embodying the same essence. In other words, specific religious beliefs can be grounded in specific experiences. So whatever the true nature of these experiences, they're leading not only to belief, but sometimes even to the founding of religions, as we've seen in modern cases. Experience can be the egg from which the chicken comes. Where the egg comes from, I think, is irrelevant here. This is not to glorify experience, but merely to re-acknowledge its proper place as one of the dimensions of religion. While some generalized universal religious experience might not be intelligible, certain specific types of them are. Again, near-death experience presents a major challenge to the types of criticisms I've been discussing. And this is for a variety of reasons, which going through will help to summarize my argument so far. First, NDEs are widely accepted by researchers from the most reductionist to the most theological of orientations as universal human experiences. They're reported cross-culturally and cross-temporally throughout history and at all parts of the world. Their occurrence is not in dispute, only their origins and meanings. This demonstrates that, second, they are phenomenologically classifiable, meaning that the thematic consistency of NDE reports distinguishes them as a particular type of religious experience to which narratives can refer. Third, wherever they occur, it is typically under objectively similar, generally physical circumstances. An individual is close to death, apparently dies, subsequently revives, and reports having gone unusual experiences. And finally, and most importantly for our purposes when it comes to the question of the origins of religions based on religious experience, the fundamental interpretation of NDEs is apparently universal. Not only in general religious, spiritual, or otherwise supernatural terms, but specifically, this is an experience of what happens when you die. The NDE is thus an elephant in the room when it comes to postmodern criticisms of religious experience. Because if there is no common experience underpinning narratives of experiences, a cross-culturally consistent anomalous experience type should not exist, and certainly should not have the same universally ascribed basic meanings. Proudfoot never mentions NDEs at all. Scharf raises them only to criticize a particular point made by Zaleski. Zaleski's book itself is largely a product of postmodernism, and as such embodies many of the problems we've already seen. First is an unwavering devotion to a preconceived conclusion, even when it means inconsistency or contradiction. For example, she spends a great deal of effort drawing convincing parallels between modern and medieval near-death experience reports, but since they're problematic to her conclusion that the NDE is through and through a work of the socially conditioned religious imagination, she ignores the similarities in order to focus on the differences. Zaleski then argues that imposing Western descriptive terms on NDE phenomena cross-culturally is to deny the testimonies of the experiencers themselves. For example, we apply our cross-culturally constructed generalizing term, being of light, to what experiencers may describe as a particular particular entity. So somebody has a near-death experience, encounters a being of light, and they say it's Jesus or the Buddha. We phenomenologically categorize it as a being of light. But I think, again, this is an example of some kind of cognitive dissonance, because on the one hand, Zaleski criticizes the mere use of descriptive terms as denying insider testimony, such as being of light. But on the other hand, she herself denies them in a far more comprehensive and deliberate way, by concluding that NDEs are entirely imaginary. Indeed, one of the hallmarks of these orientations is to purport that we, as academic outsiders, are in a superior position to our informants, characterizing those who actually have and relate their experiences as practically mindless, uncritical products of their belief systems, whose narratives have little or no value. Zaleski's argument also sidesteps the fact that near-death experiencers actually describe a being of light in phenomenologically similar ways, regardless of what culturally situated identity they ascribe to it. In fact, non-Western support for this is found in the Tibetan Bardo Thodol, the Book of the Dead, where it states explicitly that in the dying process, the Dharmakaya of clear light will be experienced in whatever form will most comfort and calm the individual. Bakking discusses near-death experiences of the near-death experience of a mathematical physicist and psychologist named John Wren Lewis, and he alleges that it's inconsistent with typical reports because it had none of the classic NDE features of tunnel, light, etc., and because it stayed with him permanently. But Lewis's experience actually does include some typical structural elements of NDEs. The tunnel motif has been shown by sociologist Alan Keller here to be a culturally situated expression of the more general sensation of entering into darkness and coming out into light. So the tunnel he associates with industrialized societies. So people in non-industrialized societies enter darkness and come in light, but we interpret it as a tunnel structure. Lewis, who had this near-death experience, speaks of an almost palpable blackness that was yet somehow radiant, which he calls the dazzling dark. The fact that the experience stayed with Lewis is certainly a common element of NDEs, as well as many other religious experiences, which are often claimed to have lasting positive after-effects. Lewis also writes of indescribable bliss and joy, of the experience being wholly ineffable, though also of a kind of infinitely concentrated aliveness or pure consciousness that has no separation within it, and therefore no space or time, a kind of description which is also quite common in near-death and other mystical-type experience reports. While Lewis himself is puzzled by what he sees to be elements that conflict with the so-called classic near-death experience, he concludes, "My intensive investigations in this area over the past decade have left me in no doubt that proponents of the so-called perennial philosophy are correct in identifying a common deep structure of experience underlying the widely different cultural expressions of mystics in all traditions." This is especially interesting because before his near-death experience, Lewis was highly skeptical. As I said, he was a physicist and a psychologist, and someone who regarded mysticism as a form of neurosis. So this demonstrates that his interpretation was not dependent upon his previous beliefs, as well as replicating studies that have shown that experience can, in fact, lead to belief. Again, McLennan, in his survey of U.S., Japan, and China, he surveyed people who stated that their beliefs did not create their perceptions, but that their experiences generated powerful, unshakable belief. To be clear, NDEs are not central to Bakking's argument in this paper, and he uses Lewis's example to illustrate his points about distinguishing between mystical experiences and mystical teaching. However, the technique of isolating a single or a few allegedly inconsistent reports in order to negate the massive evidence of consistency is another methodological error, as I've argued elsewhere on an article on that reading list. Unless we're shown precisely why, where, and how similarities are not similar, then this claim is somewhat nebulous and abstract, really. There's also unambiguous evidence that NDEs have influenced religious beliefs about the afterlife on a wider level. A 16th century Aztec near-death experience explicitly links local afterlife beliefs with the experience, which was documented by the early Spanish ethnographer Sahagún. The Salto Native Americans of Winnipeg, they told anthropologist Irving Hallowell that they gained their afterlife beliefs from dreams, mediumistic communications, and near-death experiences, and they gave the latter the greatest importance and most authority. Summarizing about small-scale societies in general, another anthropologist, Holger Kawait, writes, "When asked about the origins of their knowledge of the beyond, members of the various cultures say they gained this knowledge from the experiences of those who have returned, that is, near-death experiencers, and from shamans." Perhaps even more damaging to postmodern perspectives is the out-of-body experience, and this is because it's a single, highly specific experience rather than a composite experience like the NDE. It's also totally unambiguous. Whatever an out-of-body experience is called in any language, it's always considered an experientially dualistic state in which consciousness is separated from the body. Scharf argues that our perceptions and assumptions about religious experience lie in Descartes' notion of mind as an immaterial substance. While this is undoubtedly the case, it is also obvious that what is being described in all out-of-body experience reports is a kind of dualism. The fact that it's understood in philosophically Cartesian or Aztec or Melanesian terms is irrelevant in a phenomenological sense. That models of consciousness and its relationship to the body are culture-specific does not invalidate the existence of out-of-body beliefs and narratives cross-culturally. Interpretations of an experience need not be identical in order to be referring to the same experience type. Explicit descriptions of out-of-body experiences are common in Eastern and Western narratives throughout history, including in some of the world's earliest religious texts, again in the Atharva Veda, in the Jaiminiya Brahmana in India, in the Li Ji and Chu Si in China, and so on. An anthropologist, Dean Shields, found that of the 67 small-scale societies he surveyed, 95% of them believe in out-of-body experiences and that they are consistently described in remarkably similar ways. He summarized, "When different cultures at different times and in different places arrive at the same or very similar out-of-body belief, we begin to wonder if this results from a common experience of this happening. It is therefore neither naive nor methodologically or theoretically unsound to suggest that out-of-body experiences might have something to do with beliefs about dualism." NDEs and OBEs clearly reflect established local beliefs, as well as sharing apparently universal structural similarities. Cross-cultural differences are due to the fact that experiences are filtered through or mediated by individual and cultural contexts, then interpreted and elaborated upon in their expression. As Alan Kelly here summarized, culture supplies broad values and attitudes to individuals, and these provide individual orientation during an experience. In this way, cultural influences provide a basis for interpreting NDE content, and furthermore are crucial to shaping the retelling of the experience to others from one's own culture. So it's a case of there being genuine objective experience overlaid with individual and cultural interpretation, as well as experience during the experience, if that makes sense. Finally, there are more general methodological problems with the postmodern anti-religious experience stance, particularly in regarding philosophical arguments as axiomatic, self-evident truths not requiring proof. One unproven axiom is built upon another in order to construct an overall theory designed to circumvent criticisms through cyclical argument. Thus, according to Axiom 1, experience cannot precede culture. Hence Axiom 2, religious experience is non-referential. Hence Axiom 3, religious experience is non-comparable. And Axiom 4, religious beliefs cannot stem from religious experience. Or to simplify, as MacLennan ironically remarks, after all, if there are no true religious experiences, experiences cannot lead to religious beliefs. But there is no empirical evidence against cross-cultural similarity, against narratives referring to experiences, or against religious beliefs having origins in religious experience. In fact, there's ample evidence to the contrary for all these things, but it's summarily dismissed or simply ignored out of allegiance to a certain philosophical paradigm which purports to tell us only what cannot be, rather than engaging with what actually is. The conclusions are preordained. All that's left is to refer to the unproven axioms which make up the self-justifying paradigm. This, I think, is a confused misapplication of deductive reasoning, and that's why I consider it to be anti-scientific. Going beyond the healthy and productive reflexivity which postmodernism can offer, these perspectives actually make truth claims regarding religions and religious experiences, and therefore about basic human ontological problems. By prescribing what religious experience, and indeed religion, can or cannot be, it's a kind of philosophy of religion, and an increasingly dogmatic one. Add to all this the political factor of reducing entire concepts to mere Western colonialist constructs, and we have a very powerful, even intimidating package. Because after all, what career-minded study of religions academic wants to be seen as a politically incorrect colonialist theologian throwback? But in fact, the charge can be reversed. Isn't staking a claim for religious experience as an exclusively Western invention itself a rather colonialist stance? Do we really own experience, along with Hinduism and myth and religion? This dismantling of terms and concepts is counterproductive, even nihilistic, unless they're reconfigured and put back together again, or replaced by something better. Religious experience need not be deleted from our academic lexicon. It just needs some reconstruction, as opposed to ad nauseum deconstruction. While it's always wise to learn new lessons about old problems, I think it's certainly unwise to do away with the questions themselves. Indeed, the focus on the metaphysical and theological claims of religious experiences, by both critics and supporters alike, has clouded many other issues. Critics seem to conflate recognizing and asking questions about religious experience with making particular claims about them. But recognition and inquiry are not the same as interpretation. As mentioned, the question of whether or not religious or whether or not such experiences are real is irrelevant to the issue of their relationship to religious beliefs. We need not accept that experiences are genuinely supernatural in order to study them, any more than we need to be religious to study religions. This means that there's any number of ways of studying religious experiences, and any number of conclusions that can be reached about them. Even the experiential source hypothesis that religious experiences contribute to religious beliefs can be used to support both theological and reductionist arguments, and it is. Postmodern philosophy can be used to argue for the abandonment of the study of any category or phenomenon, ritual, conversion, even social or political dimensions of religions. While experiences need not be glorified, neither need they be negatively exceptionalized. There's no more valid reason to relegate experience to the historiographical dustbin of the field than there is to do so with any other dimension of religion. And to be perfectly frank, I also believe that there's a certain academic superciliousness at play in disregarding both emic and edic observations of cross-culturally analogous experiences and ideas, in denying an individual's own self-understanding of their experience and claiming that we know better than they do, in attempting to dictate which terms and which experiences have meaning and which do not, and especially which problems should or should not be studied in the study of religions. The study of religions is a field, not a discipline, and as such, it's wide enough to encompass a diversity of disciplines, methodologies, and theories. I am aware that the issues I've addressed today have wider implications for theoretical problems in the field. For example, if we acknowledge that there is a type of human experience which may be universally interpreted in religious terms, cross-cultural similarities can no longer be dismissed as theoretically unintelligible scholarly subjectivities. By acknowledging that such similarities do exist, we then have a category of human phenomena which can logically be called religious. And that could provide validation for the study of religion as a category distinct from other aspects of human culture, all of which would catapult us back into the dark ages of pre-postmodernist enlightenment. That's not something I actually argue for, but the point is that it should not be taken for granted that any of these issues have actually been resolved by postmodernist theories. We must remember that, though often presented as otherwise, postmodernism is but one culturally situated paradigm amongst numerous others. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Gregory, for a very robust defense of the category experience.
Thanks. Question from anyone but Hiroshi.
Glad that you defended it.
I was
really annoyed by Sharf's article myself, and I had struggled with myself. And I would say what I became really fascinated how both Sharf and Bocking are unaware of the postmodernist critic of experience in general, experience as a term, especially feminist writers like John Wallace Scott. And she wrote this article on evidence of experience, and basically she concludes this article saying that we cannot do without the term. Experience is there, and it's definitely present, but what we have to deal with is the rhetoric, the way we use it, the way we word it out, and the way we use it in the discourse. Mm-hmm. This is what we have to criticize and apply all the postmodernist critique, but we cannot throw away the concept and just say that it is not a valid object of the study. Mm-hmm. I wanted to suggest something with your paper here. It's just when you say that experience precedes culture, or this term pre-cultural, I would say that even on the level of before narrative, before the objectivization of the experience, we have culture also. Mm-hmm. So in experience, we have we can talk about non-cultural. Mm-hmm. And cultural components, but even on a generative level, I think culture very much participates also in the preconceptual on the preconceptualized level, mm-hmm. so to say. So, I would say that these are not clear cut categories. There is no like experience and then culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that culture and these non-cultural components like body, physical thing, they permeate in each other, and mm-hmm. and as far as which one of those actually causes the experience, I think we can never really say that. So mm-hmm. I think in the light of the John Wallace article, that we should be careful about how we talk about experience. Maybe this is a nice suggestion to think about whether we should be using terms like precognitive, pre-cultural, or whether there is really a pre-cultural element to experience, because pre always presupposes there is something before, and that if it's before, then it's the first, and if it's the first, it's most valued, and so there is always this notion of values. And
I guess I would just say that. Thank
you. It just shows how much I have been bothered with that.
Yeah, I think it's just that the cross-cultural occurrence of these kinds mm-hmm. of experiences is the thing that makes me think that they must be at least originate in something pre-cultural, because the diversity of culture around the world would mean that the... It doesn't explain why there would be cross-cultural phenomenologies of experiences mm-hmm. If the experience didn't precede the culture. It makes more sense to me to look at it as an experience upon which culture is overlaid. I'm just it's just conceptually, I do see where you're coming from, and I'm also uncomfortable with the idea of somebody having an embodied experience and it being non-cultural. So I don't really argue that. I just argue as soon as the experience hits, it's being, you know, washed over with the experience as the sediment and the culture.
There's about a non-cultural component. I mean, if I slap someone's face, I mean, that's most of what we experience is cultural, clearly. It's all sorts of implications, etc., etc. But who would actually deny that there is a component there that's not cultural?
Yeah.
And why should it be different for these other types of experience?
Yeah, I think so. But it's the pre-post thing is troubling. But
that's a troubling thing. What is before? Is it culture or is it biology? Is it nature or culture? You know, this is where we're falling. Well, anyway.
What is experience then?
This was a heavily cultural experience. But look, we all have human bodies, and bodies have experience of hunger, pain, and all of these other things, and near death and not so near death, and all of this to say that the things that people culturally explain and give terms to are not rooted in bodily experience seems a very bizarre, strange thing to talk about, but that's probably obvious. You mentioned somewhere along the way, and that's certainly something I've felt quite strongly, that while we should be continually critiquing and improving, I think, the terminologies, the categories and all that we use, the chucking of stuff out whole hog, and then not looking at certain areas because we've thrown out the categories for it makes no sense. And it brings me back to the person that those of you who have heard me around here before keep commenting on, and that's the late Wilfred Cantwell Smith, who was extremely wise and extremely well exposed to a large range of human experience. One of the concerns that he had in some of his later writing was trying to develop a lexicon for talking about the human religious state of affairs, not specifically or intensively the high-powered mystical or near death, but just the whole range of it, but to bring in a terminology that's out there. He has, you know, religion and faith, faith and belief, rather. He takes several key terms for faith, dharma, shraddhar, and so forth. But you've got a huge lexicon of way that Zunis and the native people, the Ojibwe, where I come from for the last many years, will talk about their strange experiences to somehow make the working terminology for the study of religion multilingual rather than strictly Eurolingual or almost Anglo-Anglo at the moment, what they should do. And my suspicion is that a number of these critical theory folks haven't really put a lot of years and labor into living in other cultures, whether they're small tribal or going overseas to India or whatnot, probably haven't learned too many. Schaff may have actually done some Buddhism, so I shouldn't be too critical. He was one of our students at Toronto. We've produced several of these highly critical folks, but not through me. I confess.
Blame you.
Well, I blame in some sense. I haven't gotten into the argument. I felt that these were guys who, with some exception for Schaff, who didn't really want to find out what the thickness of human religious experience is anywhere. They will largely stay in Toronto, and maybe they have some French or German that they can do. So I really think that the role of this center in the university, among many other things, is to try to see just what the received terminology as it develops within the various Indian traditions can contribute to what you're doing. There are different ways that experiences are shaped, and the Bengalis do it a little different from the Sanskrit crowd, I suppose that some of the small tribal folks that are still there in India that we could go out and listen to if we had the courage to and the time would be good. Anyway, I found your presentation very clear, summarizing a lot of things that I haven't been working on much, but you've got a book on this. Do you have that sets this thing out as clearly as you've said it today, or have you had to?
I think it'll be an article at least and a chapter of my current research anyway.
Okay, yeah. Well, let us know where the right chapter is, and I can slowly begin my reading. Education, post-Schaff re-entry. Go back to Toronto and not be quite as illiterate as I was, but I left saying you guys really ought to get out of Toronto.
I want to know something. Is it possible to change our shift experience, which is inherent in human body, due to socio-political and structural situations. What is postmodernist view?
I'm sorry, the postmodern view of changing...
Is it possible to change or shift experience? Mm-hmm. Because it is inherent in human bodies.
Right.
And I think it is inherent mm-hmm. due to socio-political mm-hmm. and structural situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know something, that what postmodernist view on this type of experience?
On religious experience?
Or yes, experience.
Experience per se.
Experience regarding... regarding all.
I think they would say because it's so culturally and socially rooted. I haven't read much beyond religious experience articles, so I'm not sure if they would argue, for example, about loss or any other kind of experience which is interpreted in social terms. But I'm guessing, I mean, to be consistent, it would make sense to argue that all experience is entirely culturally and socially rooted, and there's nothing beyond that. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay.
I always have a slight problem with the near-death experience, the kind of a lot of emphasis on this nowadays. Mm. It seems to me that it's just a special case of something more general, because it seems to me that those kinds of experiences occur quite regularly as part of meditation and as part of certain types of prayer.
Mm. Mm.
So the near-death is a particular situation in which those types of experience occur, rather than having anything special to it. After all, the ones that actually occur at death, we don't know anything about.
Yeah. No, I guess that just... I think addressing in one of the main critiques of the postmodernist argument that, you know, using religious experience to generalize too much, mm. I think it is useful to focus on the specific type of experience you're looking at, just to kind of make it less general,
really.
But and to identify phenomenologies of certain types of experience.
I can see what you're doing and why, but nonetheless it's making us something slightly artificial, I think.
You're right, yeah.
And if you're told that if you have that kind of experience, it's a near-death experience, you may decide that you have had a near-death experience.
Mm.
Whereas if your meditation teacher told you that's the sort of thing that happens to some people, then it wouldn't occur to you to think of it as a near-death experience.
Which is a good argument for the category of religious experience to begin with.
I don't have a problem with that.
Or mystical experience or whatever.
Yeah. But do you think that the profession of religious studies as a whole is somewhat at fault? When it talks about religious experience, almost says mystical experience, and then you look at the mystics, where what we're studying in religion is really what most of the people in the world have been doing some of the time in their lives, and what a person does in some meditation, if he doesn't even meditate, a devout person in prayer, this is religious experience, and you know, how that affects the rest of their lives is worth looking at. But I think we have tended, at least the people I've read, the grand old folks in this business, they tend to talk about religious experience to make it so different. But I don't know. My mother would somehow or other get this way. Clement the Loving, or Sweet Virgin Mary, there was something that struck her. I never could see why at that point. But she did have a slight shift in her experience, and it was important to her.
Mm.
It's pretty big, because mysticism is seen as somehow... and I use this in a positive way, the extreme end of the spectrum.
Okay.
So that's why it's so interesting. But I think most people, let's say Ninian Smart, when he identifies the experiential dimension of religions, is thinking of the whole spectrum, actually, not only... I mean, he does write on mysticism as well, but not only that end, but somehow there's something very arresting and challenging about that particular cluster of experiences, I think.
Mm. Well, I'm with him on that one.
When you use the argument, you know, that things are not dependent on previous beliefs, I was a bit worried about this, because it seems to me that you're slightly assuming that people have unified beliefs.
Hmm.
and you're slightly assuming some kind of integrated personality or selfhood, whereas I think people are much more complex than that. This is quite obvious from dreams. Mm. You know, what you experience in dreams is often things that you don't in the slightest concur with in the rest of your life. Mm. And that, to me, just suggests that we are actually much more complex and multiple entities than that. Mm. And that the very person who thinks that he's an absolutely committed monotheist may have all sorts of polytheistic urgings in some corner of their mind.
That's a good
and
point.
Vice versa, etc.
Mm. Yeah, interesting point. As well as the fact that just because an individual is culturally situated doesn't mean they're, you know, identify with a religion of whatever culture that is dominant in their world. So
yes, indeed.
I don't know that I've misunderstood what's been suggested, but I was also a bit worried about seeing the category of body as somehow prior to interpretation experience as a sort of basic given, because I don't think body is, actually. I think there are very big, cultural differences in the whole experience of body, what body means to you, whether you're a woman or a child or even in terms of, you know, whether you're a king or a slave. I think body actually is very culturally experienced.
Hmm.
I don't think it is one of those prior to culture phenomena myself.
Hmm. What about the way the body functions and the way the mind works and problem solving and experience of
The mind works sensations. Very differently if you're bipolar from if you're not bipolar. The body works very differently if you have some impediment, you know, whether it could be just whether you're short or very tall. And but it could be other more dramatic aspects of your physicality.
Mm-hmm.
And how the society perceives that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is experienced in smallness or tallness or being bipolar or being epileptic, for example, which in some cultures is, you know, as a physical phenomena, it gains enormous respect as making you very special and somehow beyond ordinary humanity, but in others is a very serious illness which has to be treated to make the body function normally. So I may be just misunderstanding.
I guess we are seeing body as something prior to the culture because, you know, literally we come in the body, like when babies are born, you know, you have first they have bodies and then they have culture. But actually, I would say that these babies are influenced by the culture even while they're in the in the womb, by everything, by what mother eats and the sounds, the noises, and all that. So who is to say where exactly does the body end and the culture begins? I think that's really
very
difficult.
Tricky.
So this is why I don't like talking about pre-cultural, because where is that exactly? Where is it?
Well, the new trend, of course, is epigenetics, isn't it, which sees there as much more cultural influence on the expression of genes than people used to think. So the whole thing has been made much, much more complex now than the kind of simple genetic theories we had.
Where does one read about that, Lance?
Epigenetics.
Doesn't come within my
life. I usually read it in diatribes from Stephen Farmer on the Indo-Eurasian literature. He gives lots of references, so I can find a lot.
Interesting. No, it's all right. I'm sure I'm not clever enough to understand it if you give me the references, but that's very interesting. That's very extreme position, isn't it?
Well, that may be... Maybe this is... I'm not sufficient of a biologist to be able to assess the evidence properly, so I'm aware that this is a trend.
Mm.
Whether it's going to be the dominant trend, I can't say.
Mm. Okay. Interesting.
On an entirely different sort of track, I did disagree with one point. If you have an experience which is not describable in terms of language...
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, of course, is usually when people say that, they go straight on to describe it.
Mm.
But if you actually had an experience that isn't describable in terms of language, it's not clear to me how you could have an opinion about that in philosophy. to say that there could not be such an experience, on what basis could you have such a...
How yourself could have the philosophical opinion about it, or how a philosopher could judge your experience?
Well, how one could validly have an opinion about it. Because, I mean, all that we're doing is verbal constructions, aren't they? That's what we're doing in philosophy, with categories and concepts. Mm. You know? And if you're dealing with something that doesn't fit any of that, then it simply cannot be analysed in that way. It seems to me irrational to attempt to do so.
You mean for philosophers to try to understand and interpret
natural experiences?
To
actually take the position that there cannot be such experience.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, that's the point I'm objecting to.
No, I agree.
Because there's no basis on which you could take that position.
Yeah.
But the assertion that if an experience is described as ineffable, it must be the same as another experience is described as ineffable is where one comes in analytically, isn't it? To say, you know, well, the smell of an orange and the smell of a rose are both ineffable, but they're very different, so it doesn't demonstrate that.
Well, there's no way I could know this in an experience I had which is not so describable is the same or different to an experience that someone else had. But I might pick up some effects of having had that experience. Sort of changes that might occur, something like that.
Yeah, I think there's a reasonable assumption that oranges taste fairly similar between us. Roses smell fairly similar. I don't know. I guess you could argue against it, but I mean things like, they...
Nobody smells a rose and thinks about, I don't know, oranges,
yeah,
right?
Nobody likes the taste of arsenic.
If you have an experience where you kind of go somewhere where nothing of what you ordinarily experience is present, it's hard to see what you can say about that. You can say it's changed you. For example, it changes you in that how you view all the things you ordinarily experience becomes different because it becomes an option instead of a necessity.
But as you said at the beginning, I mean, even if it's an experience of nothingness, the way you describe it and interpret it, that becomes a phenomenological description, which then can be compared to others.
I carefully avoided saying nothingness because that's putting one label on it.
Right.
Yeah, but you can say what you can use the closest term to it. I guess you can.
To say something is the closest term to it, gives you an implicit description, doesn't it? And there might be many, many pragmatic reasons why a mystic would do something on those lines. But I think you'd always have to have a sort of point in reserve that this can't really be valid. It's just some kind of approximation or practical means or something of that sort.
Isn't this what Shankara basically recommends, that study your Upanishads in such fashion you have these Mahavakyas and the like, but that's not it. But if you do those things long enough and rightly enough, an awareness will occur. And then you'll continue saying the same things, but you'll have the awareness, whatever in the world that means.
That's the question of what will conduce to experiences of this kind. That's a different issue. And you can look at that. You can try to positively generate it, or you can try to let go of everything else. And that variation is all over the place.
I suppose there are philosophical implications for what religious studies kind of scholars say about religious experience as well, in the sense of concerning mind-body dualism, for example.
I think so. And I think, again, that they don't really go there. And I think that, I guess take the next logical step in explaining what their, ontological assumptions are becoming. Because I think it does become a sort of philosophy of religion and states the way things are and the way things aren't in the world. It's quite they're big claims to make about a particular kind of experience, I think.
So what is experience? That's actually
Anyone seen
it?
So,
doesn't is it towards Aquinas? He says something like, "They can't be. How can you have experience of God if a mystical experience? I can't remember now, but if God is outside of the senses, as it were, how can there be experience of God in that sense?" Was that Aquinas, or am I getting confused?
He says the only thing you can know about God is what God is not, to the beginning of the He probably says that those are things as well.
This idea that experience is through the senses, but your notion of experience is broader than that, presumably. You'd want a notion of experience which wasn't restricted to the five senses.
Christian message usually distinguishes between visions that are mediated through the senses and those which are not, which deals with that problem to some extent.
This is the kind of thing you can describe it, but you know when you see it. You know when you experience it.
Well, you seem to have covered almost all the pros and cons and possibilities in the arguments, which is really good to hear.
I just hope I am.
Because a lot of it says so one-sided, isn't it?
It's, uncertainty about my understanding of their argument sometime, because I do find them, you know, there's really fine edges that you're not sure, you know, which side they're falling on. The whole question of, you know, whether they don't deny experience, especially Scharf, but he says it can't refer to an experience, the narrative can't refer to experience. It just seems to be very contradictory to me.
And Scharf, of course, is influenced by the sort of Buddhist trends to deconstruction, which of course are very ancient.
That's a good point.
Majamaka. That's what's coming in there.
Yeah. And Brian Bocking's a Buddhism scholar as well, so I do wonder if there's a certain Buddhist influence.
It's Majamaka specifically, rather than Buddhist
generally.
Okay.
It's a Buddhist atheist agnostic front.
That's a dangerous combination.
But Proudfoot is
an angry ex-theist.
And I don't think Stephen Katz was, so it's probably a non-starter.
Well, thank you, Gregory, for seeing me. It's really thought-provoking and interesting paper.
Thank you.
We're 20 minutes over our allotted time.